This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, everybody. In this episode, we're going to hear about inspiring cases in which communities have used their cultural heritage as a resource to resist gentrification. Our guests debate the conditions and instruments under which this can become possible. I spoke with Paula Marquez, Deputy Mayor of Lisbon, Maciek Czeredis from the Warsaw-based Lab of the Open Heritage Project, and Levente Poliak from the NGO Utropion. This episode is a co-production between the Urban Political Podcast and the Open Heritage Project, and my name is Markus Kipp. Among critical scholars and urban activists, the care for heritage of an urban area is often associated with strategies to commercialize, to touristify, and ultimately to pave the ground for gentrification. Neighborhood development based on its heritage all too often is geared towards creating a unique selling point of the area to attract more visitors and to create commercial services to accommodate them. From tourist shops to pricey restaurants, hotels, and furnished holiday apartments. Facades may be rehabilitated, streets renovated, but at the same time rent prices and other living expenses go up, and the area may become increasingly uninhabitable for long-term residents. Our guests throw a critical yet different perspective on this topic. I met them at the Informed Cities Conference that took place on October 15 and 16, 2019 in Warsaw. Okay, thank you everyone for participating in this discussion. And I would just ask you to briefly introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Paula Marques. I'm Deputy Mayor for Housing and Local Development, City of Lisbon.
Hello, my name is Levente Poliak and I work in an organization called Utropion and we work a lot on public civic partnerships.
Hi, I'm Maciek Czeredis. I'm an architect and a member of Open Heritage and at the same time Prague Lab.
So I'd like to first ask Paula, given the acute housing crisis and shortage in many European cities, including also Lisbon, looking at housing as a basic human right, how can we be concerned with heritage?
So, as you said, Lisbon is facing again a housing crisis. The difference from the 90s, I think, it's that we have a crisis that is not only on the most vulnerable sector families, but also in middle class. And the thing about the gentrification that, in fact, happens, I would say, a little bit spread in the city, but there's a territory where it's concentrated and is the old town, the city center, the historical city center. So, and it's where we talk a little the most about heritage. What is heritage? Is it a material expression? Is it the buildings? Is it the streets? Is it the urban design of the old city? Is it those the people that live in there, the activities? And also the spirit of the territory. And in fact, it's all this that has been affected by the gentrification and the crisis that we are dealing with. This thing about how can heritage be a way of people fight against the situation, or if the heritage is something that can promote promote the gentrification, especially when you use the heritage as a product to sell to tourism. People wanted to see the heritage, mostly the physical, the architectural, the heritage of the city. What we've been facing is that we have a lot of movements in the city center that are fighting the gentrification process and using the concept of heritage, immaterial heritage, as a way to, an instrument to force public institutions, municipal and national level to make a statement and a position, and mostly to have action on the eviction situation that we have. What the municipality did using the thing about heritage was we developed a program using public houses in the city center, historical public houses that were refurnished by the municipality, and in a specific program to in a public tender to families that were losing their houses with the crisis on private market, and houses, people that were living in the city center for the last 50 years, so they are a part of the community, especially elder people, and we promoted this program, and we are now in with 150 unities in the city center that were given by Concord to the families that were losing their houses. And in fact, it's to maintain community, it's to maintain the diversity of the, and making social, territorial and social and territorial cohesion, because if not, we are going to lose people that, yes, have low income, but have been working and creating community in the city center, in the cultural heritage that we have in the city. So these 150 families would be out of the city center if the municipality didn't take a step and act.
Thank you, Paula. Maciek, you're active in Warsaw, and Warsaw has also seen significant real estate speculation and development in which community venues and services have been lost. So how do you see the role of heritage, cultural heritage, in struggling against this development?
First, I think I would start from differentiating the term heritage into this tangible and intangible heritage, because that's, I think it's quite crucial and important to understand that these are two crucial components of heritage. It's not like that one works without another. So this, so that capital transformation of many spaces are rather perceived by many people, I think, as something positive that is bringing this new face. It's like reconstructing refreshing those tangible values. But the problem is with these intangible values that are at the same time always in all the, this kind of a process is lost. So there is no continuity. Most often those processes, those capital investments that, as I said, we can really observe in the city in a vast number, are destructive to all those fragile, vulnerable elements, like people practices, like a certain traditions, and even and people expectations to be able to use very diverse spaces or places. I can share one interesting example. This is an example of a urban structure that is very much connected to the reconstruction of Warsaw. It's very centrally located, just really few minutes from the city center, and at the same time, it's surrounded by the main cultural places of Warsaw. I'm talking about Ujazdów, housing complex, let's call it like that. It's in fact, it's a complex of, it used to be a complex of Finnish houses, as we call it in Warsaw. So these are like wooden, small wooden houses that were brought from Finland to Poland in 50s as a kind of a compensation after the collapse of German regime that was in that time supported by Finland. The interesting thing about this, that urban structure, very untypical, like it looks like a countryside. Since the Warsaw is very much a capital-oriented city in terms of investment, and from the perspective of many urban planners, that space should be urbanized, should be turned into something better than it is right now. For sure not a countryside style. It was like then there the very difficult situation happened, because at the same time some people starting to see the value of that space and manifesting that, and a lot of activists group around, you know, like trying to protect that space and those houses. And at the same time, the city obviously that wants a lot of needs to get some money from market and wanted to sell it, that land, for new developments. There was this clash between those two forces, like from the bottom up and top down, perspective. The process obviously of selling that, it was stopped. And now the situation is somehow suspended, like the process of selling it out or turning into new development is somehow suspended. I think it's still very vulnerable situation in which it can turn in both sides. But I think that here you can see how those intangible values are rather than those tangible, mm-hmm. because the houses are very simple. Probably they should be, even some of them should be reconstructed. It's not like a subject for a conservation, because it's very difficult to conservate. But the question is, shall we reconstruct other houses, and what should be the function of it? Should be still a housing complex, or maybe it should be turned into something else. So, but the issue of this continuity, you know, it's very important, and the threat to break it and stop that, like to break that continuity is still quite huge, I think.
Levente, you have experience in several European cities, working with community groups that draw on cultural heritage as a resource. Could you also elaborate a bit on your experiences in terms of how this difference between tangible and intangible heritage is articulated by those community groups?
Yeah, I think it's very important to look at why a heritage building becomes attractive on the side of big capital or on the side of communities. And what's happening is that very often big capital's sensibility follows much later a community sensibility. So this is why what we saw in many places, starting from the classical gentrification of industrial buildings in New York or London, no? That artists, communities, people who had sensibility for certain kinds of buildings, they were there much earlier, but they didn't have the tools at the time to really keep those properties or really create a long-term presence there, because in this very same moment when artists, for example, discovered industrial heritage, the real estate profession also discovers industrial heritage, and it has become very quickly a big thing. So I think what's quite important is that heritage has this the disadvantage, heritage buildings have the disadvantage that you need very often a lot of money to renovate them, so it's big capital needed, but also has the advantage from our viewpoint that that they have a special symbolic value, this intangible value of a community, of a network of people around that makes it actually very attractive for people to put a lot of energy beyond a rational calculation of my energy inputs versus my what I get out, because that creates actually a sense of belonging and the community around these buildings. I can tell you an example that I find very, very fascinating, because it has, in a way, unfolded without a lot of thinking, a lot of methodology, a lot of tools, and it was a quite spontaneous process in Rome, where a few years ago a group of practically high school youngsters who were looking for a place to study in the afternoon, well, because of austerity measures, a lot of learning rooms were shut down. They found an abandoned cinema building in the Trastevere neighborhood of Rome. And this was a very beautiful modernist cinema building from a famous architect. And they fell in love with this. They coordinated a lot. They built a discussion with the neighborhood, who were really worried. So the local community was very worried about turning this cinema into just another high-end housing in Trastevere. So at some point they had the support of the neighborhood and they occupied it. Now, that started, on the one hand, a big legal debate and also police eviction and all kinds of things. But also, on the other hand, it also started a big debate about the role of civic assets or community assets in neighborhoods like Trastevere, which is, you know, so much gentrified and so much touristified in the last 30 years. So it's, you know, mortal beings hardly ever live there anymore. And what made it also very special, that they were literally teenagers, and this attracted a lot the attention of filmmakers, like famous filmmakers who were a bit hanging out in Trastevere. And they were actually really, really afraid that nobody's going to watch their films anymore, because everybody is on their mobile phones and they watch 3-minute videos, so nobody's going to be interested in, you know, 2-hour movies by Sorrentino or Carlo Verdone. So all these people actually became really, really attracted and fascinated by this process. So there was a certain moment when these guys started what they called the Cinema America, then they called it like the collective of Cinema America. And there was a moment when they started to present a bid to buy this building. And actually, they raised, with the help of all these filmmakers, they raised 3.5 million euros, except that the owner wanted 5 million euros. So it didn't work out on the long term. But this generated so much attention that the whole movement to rethink a little bit this community assets, this cultural resources in the city, was started, and also a lot of other initiatives to reclaim cinema buildings, which are actually perfect spaces for gathering, gained an additional momentum. And also another thing that they did in a very smart way, when they were evicted from the cinema, they decided to organize a big open-air cinema, like movie festival, and they started to talk with all the small shops in the neighborhood, and they said that, look, you would close in this period of the year because you would not have really any locals to buy local stuff in your shops in summer, but we will make this big festival. A lot of people will come here. We guarantee you hundreds of people every night, and they will shop in your shop. So maybe you want to promote, you want to invest a little bit in our festival, and you know, in exchange you can advertiser, you can just have the people coming here. So that also created a very interesting economic dynamic of collecting money from the neighborhoods and creating a situation where everybody benefited, small local businesses benefited from this. And also they built up a funding model that was actually very sustainable, and it keeps on continuing. And now, I think after a few years, they have 3 locations with, I guess, every evening over 1,500 people watching movies. So it's a huge success, and I think it's a very interesting example for how a need for community spaces and also engagement and devotion can actually create very big changes.
We've talked about how cultural heritage can be both enabling condition for gentrification as well as a resource to resist it. What conditions, what instruments could enhance communities to resist gentrification through using this resource?
I can start. When we are talking about heritage, I think it's crucial to understand that we differentiate heritage from non-heritage by the by values they have to us. And for me, what is quite important to understand is that the values, as a kind of a philosophical, I would say, concept, like putting the value, like defining the heritage through values they have, is itself is an intangible heritage, element of intangible heritage. So what we, how we name something, how what kind of values we attribute to the tangible elements of the of our environment, is the process is itself is very intangible. So the most important in terms of the heritage, it's and it, that the protection of that continuity is what I'm saying is always really respect the use, respect the people who are using that tangible heritage, because the worst thing is to lose those people, because then there is a simple path to destruction, and to and it's happening very often, even with the help with the people who should be responsible for heritage, because those people, those experts, very often they are very much focused on this tangible, issues. So for them, it's even, and most of the people who are like using and transforming, obviously, that spaces, maybe not perfectly, you know, maybe they're not like keeping that spaces in the way they would like them to do it. Like they're not like making conservation works there. Because they try to simply survive, you know, using that tangible heritage. But still, that's better option for the heritage itself and gentrification, and to stop gentrification for this, than let the buildings to be abandoned, or let the space to be abandoned. Maybe it's something that we should deeper discuss, how to protect that continuity and how to simply address our activities towards the community first, not to the building first.
I think the thing is that, as you said, it's the experts that have responsibility to protect heritage are more focused in tangible heritage than intangible heritage, because it's easier. It's something that is physical, something that you can classify. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Lisbon, for example. It's easier to have patterns of evaluation on what these complex, these urban complex, these building complex are. Are tangible heritage because they have some characteristics, they have some story, history, and some story in the territory. What is more difficult is the intangible heritage, and it becomes more difficult when the intangible heritage are people, mm-hmm. are communities, mm-hmm. are ways of living, are. So I think that it's it's more difficult to experts to understand it and to make a classification if you want. I'm thinking about all the process that we have in UNESCO, for example, to define what is intangible heritage, humanity heritage, or tangible humanity heritage. And thinking, when you were talking, I was thinking about Lisbon, the example that I gave from Lisbon. I don't know if I'm going to say some names because it's the people that are living. I don't know if Antonio or Dona Conceição or Dona Constança or Carla or Rosario or Alessandra, there are people that are fighting now the gentrification process, and they are been living in the city center for a long time. I don't know if they have the conscience that they are the intangible heritage of the territory, but also the coffee shop and the small grocery from Don Annabella that it's going to close because the gentrification process. And so that's the mix between the intangible and the tangible cultural heritage. We have the discussion in Lisbon about classifying the historical stores, this historical business. I think it's really important. But and when we had the discussion about how to the patterns of evaluation, you cannot separate the use, the building, and the people that for generations and generations built that heritage. And now, in fact, we started with the combination between the building and the territory where it was, and the kind of shop it was, the kind of mostly art craft or old business, traditional business. And now we are talking about, it's not the building that is so important, it's the kind of activity that is there. And that's the immaterial heritage. So, and we are talking about the city center, the historical city center of the city. And the thing is that the big capital investments are always in the material, in the tangible heritage, to intervene in the tangible heritage. I don't know any example in the world where the capital, the big capital intervention, is concerned to immaterial heritage.
I think it's very interesting that you both mentioned of the question of how to protect certain uses, no? And I think in certain contexts, in certain heritage regulations, you can actually protect certain uses. And also, if we talk about, for example, historic shops, I think there's been a growing interest in how to define what is actually important for a community, how to protect that, but also in a way how to make those shops or those commercial exercises or arts and crafts in the end also more competitive in the contemporary environment or context. Because I can, for example, Paris puts a lot of energy into bookshops in some areas because tourism is pushing out bookshops. So how can you turn a bookshop into a more modern enterprise that still keeps its bookshop self, but it's able to sell things online, it's able to store together with other shops in the street. So how can you aggregate resources, spaces, to really upgrade the potentials of these places? And it's a lot of training, it's a lot of discussion, it's a lot of network building, but together all these, for example, commercial activities can be much stronger. Or we can think of the tools that one of our partners, the Stiftung Trieste, uses when they actually build like a separate ownership structure in all the spaces that they deal with, where land is owned by the foundation and the buildings are owned by a community, which excludes the possibility of reselling the property. So it is defined that that property, without the consent of the foundation, and the foundation was made to not allow speculation, will never be sold again. And also the uses, the functions are very, very precisely defined. That, for example, 33% art, 33% production, 33% social. So there's different ways that you can create kind of a constituting document that actually protects or reinforces a certain use. And I think ownership plays a big part in this. Network making plays a big part in this. Cultural work to build appreciation, making all these assets more visible, and also public appreciation to understand that this thing here, this place, this bookshop, this community venue is actually very important, it's crucial, and we cannot let it fall, because that would mean also the decline of the community.
I think that I fully agree that the capital is not about intangible values. But I think at the same time, they know that they are important. Because I observed that, because a few times some business guys approached me on that issue. Because I think that what really attracts people to heritage is authenticity. So there's that yes. feeling that something is real. And it really is rooted in the life. So that what roots really in the life, these are practices of people that are not artificial, but are real. And that's intangible heritage.
Okay.
And that's why they are very interested to imitate this within this transformed spaces. So trying to attract, of course, they are doing that completely wrong way. Because it's usually like to, you know, bring some artists, make exhibition, make some event, and so on, so on. So people still, I think, even if it attracts people to that event or, you know, to see that exhibition, it's not there is no continuity in that process. It's still like decoration, I would say.
One last question for reflection. The initiatives that seek to resist these transformations, they have very locally rooted histories. They have very concrete interests about their specific place. How could these initiatives actually collaborate in order to resist these larger forces that operate in these various places?
I think you can resist capital-driven development with public regulations, stronger regulations, or with other kinds of capital that is not aiming to produce just more capital, but it's aiming to produce community profit. Now, if you collaborate with different initiatives, you have more chance to put more pressure on a public administration or collaborate better with the public administration because you're seen as a more serious element of the city. So you have more chances to actually establish regulations that are making it more difficult for the big capital, investment capital, to take over real estate. And also, if you create these networks, you have more access probably to other kinds of funding. No, here we talk about, for example, how can you build a network of projects that either use a kind of a solidarity fund, that a revolving fund when you know, you need a loan to renovate a building or to buy a building, and then step by step you pay it back into solidarity fund that is actually reinvesting in other places. So many mechanisms like the Stiftung Trias that we mentioned, or other kinds of solidarity fund like Utrecht, the region of Utrecht introduced some kind of a solidarity fund like this. So it's the question, can we put some money on the table, public money or civic money or some private money that it doesn't want to create maximum profit, that is enabling communities to actually compete with big capital? And also, can we help with regulations creating criteria that actually steers the whole development or the whole regeneration into community profit more than individual big profit? So I think there's many tools, and I think this is exactly a moment of big experimentation.
Well, taxation and legislation is a crucial element, like in this broader and further perspective, obviously. But living right now and here, I think it's very important to bring or put on the table and to present to the public good examples and good experience. That this and also in such a way that people could understand that it's not by chance, it's not another form of speculation or so on, but maybe more sexy and attractive. It's just something different. It's a different approach. And I think that building models that are proven that works this way or that way is something that can really help. Let's try to build model basing on the resources and support with at least some money, you know, to be to build a kind of umbrella for this for this first fragile moment to build a sustainability of those processes behind it.
We know that the capital will be there. We know that. I think the way to face it and to make a stand is to make more to work more with the non-speculative sector, if you want. So there is a sector in society that can work with public sector that is non-public, so we could say private sector, but it is a cooperative system. I would say we should do more PCPs. It's public community partnerships. And these community partnerships can be with a local community in a small territory, or we can use that PCPs as an instrument that is spread in our cities. It's a way of doing city, the building city and community. And the cooperative, I think the cooperative system, it's the step forward that we have to do. It's to build the cities with cooperatives. And cooperatives that can be on housing, can be on production, can be on cultural sector, or can be one cooperative that have these three components. We must make clear to national level governments and European level institutions that we need funds to do it. And that's a great way to use our tax money in Europe. It's to support cooperatives and support cooperative system on building our cities.
Great. Thank you very much, Paula, Levente and Maciek.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.
More information on the Open Heritage Project, which is a European research consortium funded under the EU's Horizon 2020 framework, can be accessed at openheritage.eu.